Welcome to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTO News Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Great show coming up tonight. In the first half hour, I'll be interviewing David DeMoor, Research Team Leader, Landscape Productivity Team of the Land and Watershed Management Program at the U.S. Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station. Quite a mouthful. In the second half of the show, I'll be playing a pre-recorded interview I did earlier this week with Barney McClure, famous jazz pianist in town for the Juneau Jazz and Classics, ending tomorrow night or Saturday. Reminder to listeners, you can check out the Identity Project on Facebook by going on and looking for AIP or following it on Twitter as well at Alaska ID Project. I also have a section on my blog at adriennechile.blogspot.com, that has the pictures of all my guests and some of the recordings each week from K2. And last but not least, we have rescheduled the Maritime Festival for tomorrow. I'm very involved with organizing this, so I hope people come out. The sun is actually shining this evening, so crossing our fingers, tomorrow will be a great day. It's going to be from 3 to 9 p.m. down at Marine Park. We'll have tons of activities, including fillet challenge, marinade contest, kids' activities, lots of live entertainment, a beer garden, tours of boats, etc. So come on out tomorrow and enjoy the Juneau Maritime Festival. David DeMoor, am I doing this right, David?
That sounds fine, yes.
Even though I wish I could say it another way, is a research soil scientist with the Pacific Northwest Research Station's Juneau Forestry Science Laboratory. He has conducted forest ecosystem research in Southeast Alaska since 1994 that is focused on the interaction of soil hydrology and biogeochemistry on terrestrial and aquatic systems. His current research is examining how soil geomorphology influences forest and peatland carbon cycling and storage in the coastal temperate rainforest. Dave trained as a soil scientist at Oregon State University and then came to Alaska in 1994. He's been at the Pacific Northwest Research Station since that time. He became a research scientist in 2000 and has a PhD in natural resources and sustainability from UAF. So you're in Alaska.
Yes.
Great.
Well,
welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
Finally got you. You have a busy schedule.
Yeah, actually, I'm very glad you rescheduled the Maritime Festival because my son and I love it.
Oh,
and,
do you?
And we were
good
gone last
hear.
Weekend, so
nice.
I mean, I'm not glad you had to reschedule it, but I'm glad we'll be able to participate.
Well, we're glad we didn't do it on the windiest and rainiest day on record for May, they said.
Yeah.
It was crazy, the weather.
Yeah.
So tomorrow should be a pleasant day.
Yeah.
And we'll see you out there then.
Mm-hmm.
So the Pacific Northwest Research Station, let's start there. Let's talk about what this center is a little bit and give us some background on this landscape productivity team and its role with your work.
So the Pacific Northwest Research Station is actually based, the headquarters is in Oregon.
In Oregon, okay.
It's actually covers three states, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, and then a little part of California. And so there are several laboratories that are distributed throughout those states, and I work at one of them here in Juneau, the Juneau Forestry Science Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
It's broken into several programs of work, and so I work in one of the programs that focuses on land and water interactions, and that's the research team that I work on is Landscape Productivity, it's called, which is an august title, really that encompasses that kind of the interaction between terrestrial nutrient cycling, water movement, and how those material and energy that's transferred from the terrestrial ecosystem influences the aquatic ecosystem. Because because we're predominated by these coastal forests, and that's what a lot of work we do focuses on, we're quite interested in how those interactions play out, especially with things that depend on the ecosystem processes, like salmon is an obvious example.
Yeah, so. Of course. Mm-hmm. So how big is your team here with landscape productivity?
So we have two scientists here based in Juneau, and we have two scientists based in Corvallis, Oregon, and they're supported by three professionals here in Juneau and a professional technician in Corvallis, Oregon.
Down in Corvallis, Oregon State.
Right. So we're distributed that way because our scope of our work is throughout the whole coastal temperate rainforest.
Mm.
And so we're trying to bridge and compare and contrast northern coastal temperate rainforest systems that are typical to here in southeast Alaska, which are non-fire prone systems, with southern systems, which actually are seasonal rainforests. Mm. So they do have fire as a component in that ecosystem.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Down in southern Oregon or northern Oregon?
Yeah, so basically the west side of Oregon, dominated by the coastal temperate rainforest, but the folks down there also work on the east side of the Cascades a bit too as well. Wow. So
there's a lot of collaboration, or even more. It's increased, I'm sure, over the
years. It ebbs and flows, and of course, there's a long history of kind of this exchange of information. The research station here was actually populated originally by scientists from Oregon and Washington, and to establish the growth of the station was dominated by that. So a lot of ideas for natural resource management, forestry, different things, stream ecosystems, were actually brought up to Southeast Alaska from that area. So there's a long history of kind of this exchange as research work grew in the region, and we learned things. So what's interesting now is some of the ideas that are being generated up here are being transferred back south. Some of our research lately on how the terrestrial ecosystem is actually influencing the aquatic system is taking hold not only down there, but with a lot of our colleagues in British Columbia. Hmm. So that's pretty satisfying that we can, give some of that energy back. But it's really important to compare and contrast across systems. That's always important because if you get too focused in one area, you may not kind of spur new ideas and new things. And so it's really enriching to talk to people and in completely different systems. Again, it was really exciting for me to go to Fairbanks, to go to a tundra and boreal forest system. So, really stretch yourself coming from a wet coastal system to go up there and say, basically, Fairbanks is interesting. It's essentially a desert. They get 11 inches of rain average in a year. So a lot of people don't really know that. I didn't really realize that. You're up there and it's extremely dry and very nice. It can be very pleasant.
So less rain.
Yeah, but it's an extremely dry environment, so a completely different system.
Crazy and, within our own state.
And so I worked with a soil scientist up there, and we were always, and he was amazed when he first came down here. Dave Valentine is a professor of forest soils there, and so he was amazed when he came down here and was looking at the piles of organic matter that we accumulate because we're so wet and cooler. Uh-huh. So it was a great exchange, and I learned a lot, and it really expanded a lot of the way I thought about our system and that system, because I'd worked, my master's degree was in a wetland in Oregon, another different system, but it's really enriching when you have that kind of exchange, when you go to different places, when you challenge yourself to ask a new question. And it's a little scary at first. When I first moved up here to Alaska, I started digging peatland soils, which I had never really worked in. We didn't have
peatland.
Them. Yeah, so histosols are called.
Histosols.
In soils, there's various soil odors and that we have a special classification system in soils, and so we use a strange vocabulary to call them weird things that very few people understand. But it's very meaningful for us and for people that use soils to, exchange information actually worldwide. Mm-hmm. So if I say I'm working with a Uic dystrocrept, that somebody in, Florida will say, oh, neat.
Okay.
And so when you can interpret that, it's actually a powerful way to exchange information and to use to kind of understand, because I can study a similar soil up here and somebody can elsewhere, and we can compare information and we know we're talking about the same
language.
Kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And it, like most classification systems. So.
Well, speaking of language, you had a degree in international relations before this, right?
I did. That was my undergraduate training.
I don't know if you speak another language as well, but
I do. Je parle français.
Ah,
maybe take a bon encanto.
Español. Solamente español. But after this international relations, you go to Africa. I don't know if you had this enlightening experience, but then you switched over to science.
Yeah, it's interesting how that worked out. I trained in a classic international relations program at the University of Virginia with my destination was to become a foreign service officer. I wanted to go overseas, and I'd never been overseas and never traveled. I just loved studying history, and I loved studying international relations, and I loved everything I studied. And so I said, when I get out, I'm going to become a foreign service officer and travel the world. So I took the test and was passed the first part of the exam and was, you know, moving on to different things, you know, hoping to go, and then got a job actually selling wine.
What?
And so I moved to California and I sold wine. And because I figured, okay, well, I'll start there and we'll see. We'll wait. Well, this plays out. Well, I wasn't very content doing that.
Hmm.
But then I really enjoyed getting outside. And I had so I left that job and I started kayak touring and selling kayaks. And I was a kayak guide in New York City.
Oh, actually. Nice.
So, yeah, which was really interesting. And what people don't realize about New York is fascinating. It's the perfect place for kayaks. It's an island. There's a tremendous amount of water.
Wow.
And everybody sort of, you don't think about it because you think of a big city, but you go Manhattan. It's an island, Long Island, the sound, you know.
True.
And I grew up in, you know, near the Jersey Shore. So, when you go down ashore, you know, you got to go out in the water.
There's another language.
So the arc was I got really interested in kayaking, and then I started talking to people, and they said, well, why don't you combine your love of going overseas with science and extension and, you know, look into Peace Corps? So it worked out that I was accepted into a Peace Corps program and ended up going to Mali, West Africa, and ended up staying 2 years as a volunteer and 2 years as a training coordinator doing soil conservation and forestry.
Mm.
And so you know, kind of on-the-job training there. I worked with extension agents and different aid organizations, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was really fascinating. And in fact, I find myself going back to some of the lessons I've learned there and some of the challenges we're having now, especially with renewable energy. And as we start talking about, well, what are we going to do? There's a lot of challenges. So similar kind of things, different scale, different idea, but it was the same idea. What do we do? How do we use these natural resources? How do we serve the needs of people? What are we going to do? How do you do the right thing and also conserve the resource?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's how I did it, and I ended up moving back to the U.S. You always get into an interesting transition. After about 4 years, I heard this from my friends, it's like you can either stay, and you'll probably stay the rest of your life. And I still have colleagues and friends that are still over in Africa. And then, or, you know, you sort of arc back to the domestic side, and I sort of arced back and have been here ever since. But that's how I ended up really loving soils, strangely enough. And I really, really love soils. I actually got fascinated by it by working with a French aid agency, and they were soil scientists.
Uh-huh.
And so they taught me all kinds of interesting things, and I said, so, and every time we would go somewhere, everyone would ask about the soils when I'd go, and I'd be like, boy, everyone's asking about the soils. Why aren't there more soil scientists? And so we're actually a fairly rare breed. You know, you don't have a lot of soil scientists out there. It's a discipline that sort of ebbs and flows, and traditionally soil scientists are usually associated with agriculture and agronomics.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, but there's a large body of soil scientists that do, like I do the work with natural systems and natural managed forests. But so it's sometimes it's hard to recruit, you know, students to go into it because they think, well, I don't want to go into agriculture. And it's like, well, you don't have to.
I don't want to live in Iowa.
there's a lot of other areas to go into it. Environmental engineering really is essentially a lot of that is soil, you know, containing contaminants in soils, remediation of sites, constructed wetlands for, you know, sewage treatment. All that has to do with soils and the biogeochemical processes that occur in soils. So it's a fascinating field, and I met these soil scientists, and I said, I want to be a soil scientist. I mean, strange thing, and I really liked soil.
Soil.
But I still wasn't convinced to go into science, though, and it was interesting. I came back, and I was still on a different tangent. So I was at a university, University of Rhode Island, and I was visiting another department that was still going in the social science direction. I said, no, I'm better at policy. I'm better at, you know, I need to be a policy person. And I sat down with the person I was talking to said, you need to go up and talk to this professor upstairs. Turns out it was a soil scientist. And this was back in 1990. And he said, and I said, well, I really want to work with water, estuaries. I was still into kayaking. And I said, he said to me, I remember this very clearly. He said, if you want to understand the estuary, he said, you need to understand the soils.
Really?
So really, he was on that whole track of the terrestrial aquatic connection.
Mm.
And they had a big project looking at terrestrial processes in Rhode Island and how that was affecting the estuaries along the coast. And so I said, wow, that's really neat. So I'm very satisfied. And I saw him at a meeting about 8 years ago, and I told him this, and he was, I said, we've been able to bring that story and really embellish it, in the coastal temperate rainforest and kind of bring that idea. So that's really exciting. But that really got me fired up. And he said, if you're going to do this, he said, you need to go back. You need to take all these classes. You need to get a master's degree and get your PhD degree and, you know, get out there. And so I said, okay.
Yes, master.
Sounds easier than it really was. But that's been the path, you know. And so from that point on, I went into the more technical side of soil science. And as I call it, I'm trained in, hard rock soil science, which is describing profiles, digging holes.
Wow, even more specific.
Yeah, very specific. So, yeah.
Well, if you're just tuning in out there, we're talking to Dave DeMore, and he works at the Pacific Northwest Research Station, soil scientist for the Forest Service here. And let's get into some of your research, because we obviously don't have a lot of time, but I want to highlight some of your things you've been working on. There's two major focuses, yellow cedar decline and carbon cycling. And it's interesting. Both of them are fascinating. Mm-hmm. So let's start with the yellow cedar decline and highlight maybe the problem with some of these issues. Yes. If anybody's found a solution.
Yes. Yellow cedar decline research dates back a long way, but I was brought into it by my colleague Paul Hennen.
Okay.
And Paul Hennen has really made most of his career at studying yellow cedar, and it's very satisfying that we've actually had some breakthroughs recently.
Okay.
That are actually outlined in a paper that was published in the journal Bioscience, and we're pretty happy that we were able to compile a lot of the recent research work that Paul's done for the better part of 25, mm-hmm. 30 years, and then especially the last 10, 12 years working together in a coordinated research team, and many of the people on that paper are co-authors. So yellow cedar decline was a very perplexing issue, and it, Paul had worked and eliminated a lot of, in the good reduction of science approach, had eliminated a lot of the possible causes. It was kind of at a crossroads when I became a research scientist at the lab and said, you know what, we need to start looking more at the soils and some of those mm-hmm. aspects of the decline problem. And so we kind of created a small, informal team where we started doing some experiments and research and expanded that to some colleagues actually in Vermont that do cold tolerance mm-hmm. testing, Paul Schauberg and Gary Hawley. Paul's at the Forest Service Northern Research Station, and Gary's at University of Vermont and some of their students. So together that was kind of a core group that sort of started unraveling some of the intricacies. And again, I won't go into the whole story. It's actually a fairly complex interaction factors. But what it came down to was there was something going on with snow and hydrology and the tree freezing tolerance, and so the cold freezing tolerance. So what we've actually unraveled is this interaction where it appears that we've lost snowpack over the past century, mm-hmm. and that has exposed the fine roots of yellow cedar to freezing injury, which we believe is the proximal, the real key cause, that their fine roots are getting frozen because they've lost the protection of snow, and we're getting we still get spring kind of a cold freeze, much mm-hmm. like your garden gets shocked by cold freezes and it kills all the flower buds and everything. Same idea. If there's no protection for these plants and they're actually growing, it kills their fine roots. So over a period of time, it loses the fine roots, it loses its ability to acquire nutrients and water, and the trees die. And so this has occurred in waves over the last century, which was dominated by a pulse in the 70s and 80s. And so again, it's a really interesting kind of climate-related tree decline that we didn't start looking for a climate signal there. We really thought there was something going on that maybe it was a toxicity or something to do with the soils. But what's emerging as a climate phenomenon due to our loss of protective snow and just the habit of the tree, the habitat, the niche it occupies. Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting story there. I mean, we think that it occupies these niches because it can grow there. It outcompetes the other trees.
The strong tree, I was reading.
It grows in marginal conditions. It's
okay.
A survivor. As Paul likes to explain, it's a defensive. It's got a strategy of I'll outlast you.
Strategy.
You know, it doesn't grow real fast in these environments, the wetlands. You know, it's kind of in wetland, wet environments that aren't the greatest for nutrient cycling. So it was always a perplexing question of why would it grow there? And we believe that that has to do with its nutrient acquisition strategy. It can use a technique where it uses different forms of nitrogen. That it can acquire in that environment,
depending on circumstances,
that spruce and hemlock don't seem to have to use because they're more adapted to disturbed conditions and the general disturbance cycle of the forest. Whereas the cedars, yellow and red cedar, kind of exist in this ecotonal area between our open bogs and wetlands and the healthy mature forest, you know, the productive forest, the well-drained soils.
Okay.
So cedars can grow really well in well-drained soils when they get established. I mean, they get huge. Paul and I gave a webinar through the University of Alaska Fairbanks Alaska Climate Change Group the other day, and a woman called in from Sitka saying, you know, there are two huge yellow cedars that you should come look at. So I'm looking forward to getting over there and seeing them. So that gives you a little idea of where we're going. But it's a good example, too, of how, you know, the teamwork and kind of different projects can kind of lead to a better understanding. And I hesitate to say we've solved it. I mean, there's still a lot of interesting questions, but we've reduced the uncertainty of the factors that are related to the phenomenon a great deal.
Interesting. And if people are interested in reading more, they can Google your name or there's a website for
The
center?
Yes, the information is well distributed through both the Forest Service website and just online is a great way to acquire things by just kind of even Yellow Cedar, Alaska and different ways like
people
that. Yeah, it's pretty easy to find it, yeah.
Okay, so carbon cycling.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe let's just briefly address the concept, what we're talking about, and then this research, and it's obviously related to climate change as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to read some highlights from your paper, but what's this project about?
So carbon cycling in general is a great concern because a lot of agencies and different people are kind of looking at various aspects of carbon for, you know.
I guess we can go to a quick break real quick. Yeah. She's pointing out there's a phone call here. So I guess we'll... Susan? I guess we'll see what's going on. I wonder if somebody's calling with a question or something.
Oh, do you have that?
I don't know if we can put them through. Okay, we'll go to a quick break and be back with Dave DeMore. Oh, my God. I've never had a phone call come in. It's for you. Sorry. She's, like, pointing at him. We're back here on the Last Guide to Any Project. This is Adrienne Lopez here on KTO News We actually had a caller calling in, which has never happened, but Dave's popular, so we're going to utilize the rest of our time here. Getting
quick
back into the question.
Quick rundown on carbon.
Carbon cycling. Pacific Northwest Research Station reminder, that's where David works in.
So, of course, carbon cycle is a big concern and interest because forest, especially forest and the terrestrial ecosystem, provides a large buffer for atmospheric concentrations of atmospheric CO2. So what's a big question these days with a lot of terrestrial ecology is, well, how much carbon is sequestered in the terrestrial ecosystem? Mm. And what is the cycling rate of that carbon? And so a lot of the big questions, especially in soil science, are, how stable is that carbon?
Mm-hmm.
So we know over time that the large pools of carbon, it shifts. The ocean's actually the largest pool.
Okay.
So it stores a huge amount of carbon in the ocean. And so the diffusion of CO2 from the atmosphere into the ocean is the general exchange there. But we're also learning about, again, this exchange from the terrestrial ecosystem to the ocean through dissolved forms of carbon. One of the big plants, take in carbon dioxide, as part of their growth process, fix carbon through that mechanism. And so how fast, where does it go? Generally, the bulk of that carbon turns over rather quickly. So during on an annual basis in with the growth of plants. So here in the coastal temperate rainforest, a lot of that carbon doesn't move very fast because we're so cold and wet. Our decomposition process is impeded, so we tend to accumulate it. That's why we've only had 10,000, 14,000 years since the glaciers have retreated, but we've accumulated a huge amount of carbon, actually, in our system here.
Mm-hmm.
So a big question in systems like this is how stable, how persistent will that carbon stock be? Obviously, it's a big, stockpile that's kind of locked in the terrestrial environment.
Mm-hmm.
And, there are concerns about with changing environmental conditions, what may happen to that. And there are different trajectories. I mean, this is where it gets really interesting and science becomes fun, because you can have a trajectory where the plants will just grow more vigorously and fix more carbon, and so we'll accumulate a lot more. Another trajectory is that the stored carbon may destabilize because as you warm it up, microbial processes especially and biological processes start speeding up. And so you may decompose and mobilize that carbon. And here we have two important vectors. You can go up as a gas through decomposition through what's called soil respiration, and that's CO2 that's evolved back to the atmosphere as a gas. It can also come out of wetlands as another gas called methane, and that's another source. And then a third source, which generally not a lot of people pay close attention to, is the dissolved form of carbon, or dissolved organic carbon forms that actually come out of our streams. And in this area, if you've ever seen a real brown-looking stream, a lot of people call them tannic streams, that's organic acids that are in the streams.
Ocean acidification.
Yeah. Well, it's not a direct link. Again, we're starting to wonder what that carbon is doing. It's a nutrient source. We know that. Some of the work we've done has shown that it can be used in streams as a nutrient source. It also can get into estuaries and provide and be deposited and stored in the sediments of estuaries. So we have sort of another source of storage.
Wow.
But then again, it is an organic acid, so it has a lot of what are called acidic functional groups. So it does have an interaction that can cause different changes in what's called the ionic strength or the mix of the species, and certainly may have an interaction with the pH of the water. That's generally controls the pH, is that ionic mix of ions in solution. So, it's a good question. What's going to happen? And, again, it's been a big focus of a lot of work we've done. My colleagues Rick Edwards and Aaron Hood have been working on terrestrial aquatic linkages along with me. Aaron especially has been looking at glacier melt and some of the material that flows out of glaciers. And so, again, we have a nice research team that's kind of trying to figure out how that soup, as it were. The ionic soup is what the fate of that is in a near shore coastal environment.
Oh, it'll affect policy, which I wanted to get into a little bit, but I didn't realize the time is out, Dave. But people can go online again. They can check out all of your studies. You can Google Dave Dillmore or the Pacific Northwest Research Station as well. You've also done some stuff with salmon with this riparian streams, which is funny because I had Salmon in the Trees lady on, Amy Gulick, a few months ago, and she was talking about something that I think you're now refuting. But anyway.
we're embellishing.
Embellishing.
I think that, you know, there's salmon in the trees and there's soil in the salmon, as my colleague Rick likes to say.
So nice little quote. Yeah.
So I think we got to think of it both ways. That's the story there. I think there's an interesting mutual exchange from the salmon coming back to the forest and the forest actually exporting a tremendous amount of material to the streams. Yeah.
Wow. Well, great. Well, thank you for sharing with us and all the work you do and continue to do, and good luck. And
pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you on the show. Dave Dillmore with the Pacific Northwest Research Station soil scientist. We are going to leave you with Barney McClure because he'll be the next interview here on the Alaska Identity Project. His song is Spot, and he plays it with a Hammond B3. He's going to be out tomorrow night finishing up Jazz and Classics. So if you're out and about and can watch him, go out. And thanks for listening tonight. This is Adrienne Lopez. Take care.